You really are in the middle of a three-session thing this week, but I hope they're all self-contained enough that it does not require that you're at the whole series. I'm going to review just very briefly what we did last Wednesday. We primarily looked at a book by Robert McAfee Brown and another book by Lonzo Del Vasto. Today we're going to concentrate most on Martin Luther King and Mahatma Gandhi, and Sunday the whole hour will be on Thomas Merton. I think we titled it Readings in Nonviolence. We found out last Wednesday that you need some clarification of terms before that really makes a lot of sense, but maybe you'll catch some of that discussion as we review. I'm going to start with a clarification that Lonzo Del Vasto did in a talk, and then it's also in his book, Warriors for Peace. He made it very clear that what we're talking about in nonviolence is an approach to conflict situations. Not the absence of conflict in your life, but when, in fact, you do have conflict situations, and I want you to know my assumption is if you are a Christian, you will have them, that's part of what it means to be followers of the way is to stand counter-culture in lots of ways. To stand up for something always means you might then have to speak out or to confront someone who has a different point of view. When you're in those conflict situations, what are the options one thinks of? And Del Vasto goes through four of them that I think we would commonly think of. In fact, Wednesday they came out rather quickly. First is fight. And the world has always respected that, at least as the, quote, manly response. And I think that's good to use that in the context of this week when we're talking male, female. And it's at least the macho response, right? The opposite of that is flight. The opposite of fight is to run from it. The other two get a little more difficult to be concrete about. They're not quite so this or that, the opposite of one. One is to try to remain neutral. Maybe the phrase, well, I won't get involved. And the fourth category is to, in some way, capitulate or give in or surrender. And the important thing, as far as I'm concerned, when Del Vasto covers those four options, is to make clear that what he means by nonviolence is none of the above. And in his summary of that, he says, most people understand it is certainly not fight, but most people, until you really take some time to talk through what this means, think of it as some combination of the other three, namely flight, capitulation, or refusing to get involved. And he wants to, as clearly as possible, show that it is not only the opposite of fight, it is not those other three. It is none of the above, or it's an alternative to those in conflict situations. The reason that I recommended these two books last time was it seems to me that someone who wants a starting book in a very broad discussion of peace, nonviolence issues would do well to read this book. First of all, Robert McAfee Brown does not come from a convinced position. And sometimes someone who is himself struggling with it, you really have an easier time with that than though someone is convinced and you find yourself defending or feeling like a dud if you don't go as far as that author does. If you're wrestling with it, I think Robert McAfee Brown you'll find is a very honest wrestler. He has flip-flopped from a kind of what he would call naive pacifist position, which was shattered by the Second World War, the advent of Adolf Hitler, a tract by Reinhold Niebuhr on why the Christian is not a pacifist. Then he saw new reasons for thinking in terms of nonviolent action, especially with Martin Luther King and maybe Chavez and the lettuce boycott and the farm workers. He is now questioning that again in the third, fourth, and fifth world struggles and oppression, and he wonders if nonviolence, as it has been tried in Namibia for over a dozen years, really is a possible way, or whether they need to have some kind of violent revolution. You'll find a wrestling with the peace, just war, crusade, pacifist, just war, crusade debate or discussion throughout the history of Christianity. Find some idea of why the emerging poor nations of the world are confronting us with the possibility of a just revolution, and do our old criteria of just war have something to say on whether or not there's ever a just revolution? A very good starting book if you don't have either the time or the possibility of reading Roland Bainton, who is more complete on the peace war issue, Martin Luther King, who's more complete on the nonviolent issue, liberation theology, which is more complete on the on the differentiation in the world today, the gap between rich and poor. Brown touches many of them and has a very complete bibliography at the end. The other book is very different, and I wanted two different ones last Wednesday. This is a personal pilgrimage. This is the journal that a man kept on his own journey through India as he tried to find for himself that inner centering that would give his life meaning. He found it as he visited with Gandhi, went back and established the ARC, which is a community of probably 100 people now in France, and a consistent nonviolence. We gave some indications of that last week, from the way they eat, to the clothes they wear, to the kind of rejection of anything mechanical. They are purists in a way that I think shocks us and either excites you or turns you off, but they are purists. They are consistent. If we were in the Ark today, we would be sitting on the floor, because at the Ark they always ask, is it necessary? Not, is it comfortable? And so far they have no one who needs to be 21 inches off the floor, so at this point they have no chair. All right. We shared those kinds of things last week. Let me share three passages that I did not get to last week to give you some idea of Del Vasto's understanding of nonviolence. Nonviolent resistance exemplifies itself to be more active than violent resistance. This is because we started last week with the idea that some people think that it's passivity or being passive, whereas it's exactly the opposite of that, and I want to pick some of the places where those people who live it and write about it make that very clear. It is more active than violent resistance. It requires more daring, a greater spirit of sacrifice, more discipline, and more hope. It obtains its results on the plane of tangible reality as well as on the plane of conscience. It brings about a profound transformation in those who practice it, and sometimes a surprising conversion of those against whom it is carried out. I can see how I can teach nonviolence to those who know how to die. To those who are afraid of death, I cannot. One other section on nonviolent resistance. I think I'll skip that one. Oh, there's an aspect that I think we ought to mention, and he mentions it at this point. It's generally thought of in terms of some community of people who are committed to it, not an isolated single individual trying to live out a nonviolent lifestyle. I guess a single individual can stand as a prophetic voice, but in the history, and we had some discussion Wednesday, whether or not there are really any times when great social or economic or political changes came about nonviolently, and there are some books that cover the history, and there are many times when that happened, usually with a group of people committed to it. I knew that to give this truth, namely the truth of nonviolence, to give this truth life, it was vain to expose it in books, scatter it abroad in lectures or public speeches, vain to theorize, vain to appeal to those who read out of curiosity, or to the crowds that hear and forget, for it is the kind of truth that one can learn only by living it, and teach only by helping someone else to live it. It was therefore necessary to found a community of people bound by solemn vows for the purpose of learning to live together according to the rule of ahimsa, and that's the word in India for nonviolence, to make this community thrive in poverty and hard bodily labor and grow in independence, while nevertheless subject to civil law, so that in time and with the help of God, without preaching revolt or forcing destiny, it would transform the life of the peoples from within, eliminating bloodshed and revolution and the endless chain of wars. All right, those are what we did Wednesday, and you have some idea of what that book is about, if that's the kind of thing you like, an autobiographical journal of a person. I think you have found, from what we've said, and probably when we started talking, if I had asked for the one person that you might think of first when you think of nonviolence, it was probably Gandhi. Religion and Violence refers to him. Del Vasto went personally to visit with him. Martin Luther King, I think, would say that it was in the tradition of the Sermon on the Mount and Gandhi, more than any other thing, that formed his recent expression of nonviolence in the United States. So let's turn a little bit to a small, frail, brown-skinned man wearing a loincloth and confronting the British Empire with long periods of fasting. Martin Luther King says this about him: "As I delved deeper into the philosophy of Gandhi, I came to see for the first time its potency in the area of social reform. Prior to reading Gandhi, I had about concluded that the ethics of Jesus were only effective in individual relationships. The turn the other cheek philosophy and the love your enemies philosophy were valid only, I felt, when individuals were in conflict with other individuals. When racial groups and nations were in conflict, a more realistic approach seemed necessary. But after reading Gandhi, I saw how utterly mistaken I was." Gandhi was probably the first person in history to lift the love ethic of Jesus above mere interaction between individuals, to lift it to a powerful and effective social force on a large scale. Let me just share a couple quotes from Gandhi, and then I'm going to have some briefer ones from a book that Merton did on Gandhi. Satyagraha, let me go back once more to Wednesday, and then I don't think I'll have to do that anymore. Gandhi very rarely used the phrase nonviolence. And as we began to talk about it Wednesday, perhaps we got some sense of why he refused to use it very often. It is a negative term. It sounds like the absence of something, even by the having the non in front of it. So the only thing you know for sure is it is not violence, but you don't, in the nature of the term, have much of a positive sense to it. Satyagraha, as far as I know, he coined the phrase. He was the first one to use the phrase. Do you know if that's true or not, Nehemiah?
Yeah, he is the
first to use it. All right. It means literally clinging to truth. As you try, however, to put that in our language to communicate, there have been other phrases: soul power, truth force. At least it's a very strong and positive term, not the absence of something. Truth, for Gandhi, was God. Satyagraha, in the general sense of the word, means the way of life of one who holds steadfastly to God and dedicates his life to him. Satyagraha, in the narrower sense, in which it is ordinarily understood, means resisting evil through soul force. For the required soul force, the individual has to discipline himself in self-control, simplicity of life, suffering without fear or hatred, recognition of the unity of all living beings, and wholehearted and disinterested service of one's neighbor. Let me put those things once more for you, because that's kind of a cluster of attributes or themes that I think are important if you're going to understand Gandhi. Self-control, simplicity of life, suffering without fear or hatred, recognition of the unity of all living beings, and wholehearted and disinterested service of one's neighbors. I think unless you understand the inward strength or power that Gandhi called for in the lives of Satyagrahi, those are the disciples of nonviolence, you will not understand the actions. Unless you understand the role of fasting, daily disciplines that included keeping a journal, spinning, and taking a walk. They don't sound like the three things necessary to be a revolutionary. Unless you understand something of that, I'm not sure you'll understand a salt march. Those are perhaps the things that he's most famous for, and I'm certainly willing that we include those in our discussion today, but I guess I'm trying to get behind those a little bit. For instance, in the salt march, much of the time, Gandhi was leading people in protest against unjust, usually economic, laws from the British that affected the lives of the people who lived in India. One of them was that they could not take the salt from the ocean. They had to buy imported salt. The spinning wheel was a symbol for the same reason. They could not weave their own cloth. They were supposed to buy the British Empire, and its vast kind of economics required some countries buying from the mother country and the raw materials going there for the whole thing to work. And sometimes that was a hardship on the people who lived in the scattered parts of the Commonwealth. But on the salt walk, or the salt march, Gandhi, with great spiritual discipline, a long fast, praying through the night, started out in the morning and marched toward the sea to illegally pass through a fence that had been set up and to get some salt. White-robed, perhaps singing or praying, smiling, without arms, walk toward the soldiers, and they got their heads bashed in. And the next group would come and bring them back, and another group would walk toward the soldiers. And by 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I don't know how many had been injured, there were wave upon wave of Satyagrahi who had had their heads smashed in. And at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, if I remember the hour, something like that, the British soldiers threw their clubs down and said to the commanding officers, in essence, I will not hit one more defenseless person who walks at me smiling. I'll not bash in another head. And it was all over. It finally just wasn't the way soldiers were built. It was a kind of a strange thing for them. All right. Gandhi's point was, we attacked a law that we thought was unjust. We were not passive. We had a lot of suffering that day. Not as much as though we had tried to get guns and fight the soldiers. There would have been more suffering and more people would have died had we gone to armed conflict. But most important, we endured all the suffering and we caused none to the enemy. Somehow I'm trying to get behind how a group of people could have done that. It's still a shocker for us. All right. These are some of the things behind that. And I'm just going to pick some quotes. Then we'll pause. But I want you to get some cluster of these so that it begins, some things begin to break through. And I have them marked, not little pieces of paper in each one, so just give me time to flip through, and I think it'll go just as quickly. The whole Gandhian concept of nonviolent action and of satyagraha is incomprehensible if it's thought to be a means of achieving unity rather than the fruit of an inner unity already achieved. Contrary to what has been thought in recent centuries in the West, the spiritual or interior life is not an exclusively private affair. In other words, for Gandhi, the living out of that was an extension of the spiritual life into the social and into the political. A society that lives by organized greed or by systemic terrorism and oppression, they come to much the same thing in the end, will always tend to be violent, because it is in a state of persistent disorder and moral confusion. For Gandhi, there's a direct connection for the individual and the society between an orderliness and a centering down. It's one of the disciplines, the spinning, it's one of the reasons for the spinning wheel. It's a way to center yourself. Okay. And that's a very important part of what he has to say. Sometimes the idea of nonviolence is taken to be the result of a purely sentimental evasion of unpleasant reality. And I want to say that's exactly the opposite of the people that I'm sharing with you. It is not an evasion. It is not living in some dream world that does not include violence. It's a very conscious recognition that this is a violent world. It is not naive. Okay. Now let me get to some of the brief quotes. Nonviolence is not a garment to be put on and off at will. Its seat is in the heart, and it must be an inseparable part of our very being. The acquisition of the spirit of non-resistance is a matter of long training in self-denial, appreciation of the hidden forces within ourselves. It changes one's outlook on all of life. It is the greatest force because it is the highest expression of the soul. I know that all of this cannot be proved by argument. It shall be proved by persons living it in their lives with utter disregard of consequences to themselves. Nonviolence, which is a quality of the heart, cannot come by an appeal to the brain. The first principle of nonviolent action is that of non-cooperation with everything humiliating. I think that's an important one. I really think sometimes people think that it's remember that poster, turn the other cheek, nothing will make him madder than that, or some such thing, that it's really a manipulative way to humiliate. You'll get your own way in what Gandhi would say is just as violent. Okay, it is not that. It's not a way of humiliating somebody and bringing him around that way. The conditions necessary for the success of satyagraha, he lists three at this point. The satyagrahi, that's the disciple, should not have any hatred in his heart against the opponent. Secondly, the issue must be true and substantial. And three, the satyagrahi must be prepared to suffer even to the end. Nonviolence is not a cover for cowardice. It is the supreme virtue of the brave. Cowardice is wholly inconsistent with nonviolence. Nonviolence presupposes the ability to strike. It's a conscious choice not to. It does not come out of impotence. If one has pride and egoism, there is no nonviolence. Nonviolence is impossible without humility. My own experience is that whenever I have acted nonviolently, I've been led to it and sustained in it by the higher promptings of an unseen power. Through my own will, I should have miserably failed. Then one that I think is really important. It's been said a couple times, but I want to repeat it. It is better to be violent, if there is violence in our hearts, than to put on the cloak of nonviolence to cover my impotence. Let me repeat that. It is better to be violent, if there is violence in our hearts, than to put on the cloak of nonviolence to cover my impotence. Violence is any day preferable to impotence. There is hope for a violent man to become nonviolent. There is no hope for the impotent. In life, it is impossible to eschew violence completely. So the question arises, where is one to draw the line? And the line cannot be the same for everyone. Meat eating for me is a sin, yet for another man who has always lived on meat and never seen anything wrong in it, to give it up simply to copy me will be for him a sin. Nonviolence in the sense of mere non-killing does not appear to me to be any improvement on the technique of violence. What it means then is slow torture. When slowness becomes ineffective, then we would immediately revert to killing and to the atom bomb. All right. I think a couple of those are included to shatter some of the stereotypes we have before we study someone like Gandhi. To also take away the idea that it's an unambiguous place to stand. There are some inconsistencies when you read Gandhi. There are some questions that still remain with you. And I'm always afraid of the someone who offers me the guiltless place to stand or any system that has no ambiguities anymore. So all I'm saying is the people that I know and respect in nonviolence do not offer that to you. But I hope that you sense something of what Gandhi said and wrote and lived. And before we get to King and the most recent experience in the United States of someone committed to this satyagraha, let's pause for some discussion or questions.
Is it possible that, I'm thinking about Bonhoeffer, maybe that was discussed the other day. Bonhoeffer, I understand, was a pacifist.
He referred to himself as a pacifist, I think, throughout his life.
And then the famous statement, you can bandage up the victims of a reckless driver, but sooner or later somebody must take that reckless driver from behind the wheel. And therefore he went along with his relatives and friends in the attempted assassination. And I understand that to be a renunciation of his previous position of nonviolence. Is that right? I don't know that much about it, but I'm seeing Bonhoeffer as kind of a classic test case of the use of nonviolence to a point.
Mm-hmm.
And then in his, what was, as I understand it, kind of an agonizing change of heart for him to participate in that attempted assassination. How do you view that? Have you read about that? And what do you think of all that?
Larry Rasmussen, who was here on faculty, has a pretty good book on Bonhoeffer and did his doctoral thesis in it. And he and I have talked about that particular thing or other things at some length. I'll give you my reaction, but then I'd like it to be more than you asking a question and me giving an answer. But I'll tell you where I am. John Howard Yoder, the Mennonite, who will be here in a couple weeks, has a helpful little book called Nevertheless. And I think, we can ask him when he comes, I think he wrote it partly so when someone says, are you a pacifist, he can say, what do you mean by that, which kind, because nevertheless has 24 separate things, all of which are either called or the people themselves call themselves pacifists. And there's a great spectrum in it. Mm-hmm. I think we tend to think pacifists have our own limited idea of what that means and then say, was Bonhoeffer a pacifist or not a pacifist? Maybe within his own mind he was consistently a pacifist, even in the assassination plot. At least it doesn't shatter me. It may shatter one of my ideas of what pacifism is. Okay, that would be the first reaction. My second reaction would be that he probably is where I now am myself. And so I can understand calling himself a pacifist. I have a friend who was just elected bishop of our southern district in Texas, Augie mm-hmm. Wenzel. And when he and I gave a thing together, in fact, Pastor Tesh was there at Lake Buchanan Lake. He gave some things on this, and someone said, are you a pacifist? And he paused and said, almost a pacifist. And I think he would have answered very similar to what I'm going to say. I think the bulk of the Christian history, early Christian history, certainly of the New Testament, of the Sermon on the Mount, of the ethics of Jesus, would say that we're called upon for a lifestyle that goes a long way toward the typical definitions of pacifism and nonviolence. When the weight of the evidence would have to come to say why you were leaving that stance for a particular point in history, rather than a Lutheran young person coming to the congregation and having to have that person give the weight of evidence as to why they were a selective, conscientious objector, I would think you'd come to the Christian community and say why you were a selective, conscientious participant, that the bulk of the weight would be non-participation in violence, but that perhaps there were times when you went against what you really thought was not only the ideal, but the Christian stance, and at least at the end of that, which is where Jacques Ellul is, at least the Christian faith says that's what we ask forgiveness for, our complicity in a violent world, and therefore our sometimes making a choice, and that's what forgiveness is. Those are the kinds of things to confess. We have, most of our confession has to do with personal piety and saying bad words and thinking sex thoughts, or, you know, he said that's probably the bulk of what my call is, and that's where I err when the violence is inevitable, and I have two choices, and they're both violent, or some such thing. Does that begin to speak to the question?
Thank you.
You are, as far as I know, you're fairly accurate on calling. Bonhoeffer referred to himself as a pacifist and did participate in the assassination plot. Now let's expand that discussion a little bit. Other people have reactions to it or feelings on it?
I'm going to ask a question.
All right.
What do you think about getting back to voluntary, the draft? This all involved, isn't it?
Yes, that's part of this issue broadly. Certainly is on the peace war part of nonviolence. Yes?
I think about security on one point, and then I think about people's rights. I think they have more and more young people who would not sign up for a draft.
The most
upon the
all
nature
right.
of the defense, I guess, of the country,
yeah.
whatever the issues are.
Okay, let me just say this, and then we'll go on with that.
Okay.
By the Lutheran criteria for just war, Vietnam did not fit any of the criteria. Therefore, you had more selective, conscientious objectors in the Lutheran Church on that than you did, like on World War II. But that should have been an expected response to a just war criteria theory. Now, so that the most recent experience of this nation had more people who conscientiously opposed being in the military service. But I'm okay. So that the most recent experience of this nation had more people who conscientiously opposed being in the military service. But I'm okay. Is there a further question?
No, I think
okay. All right. And it was very difficult in Lutheran parishes. The 4 years ago when we started the Ministry for Peace and Nonviolence, funded by the American Lutheran Church, the amnesty issue, you'd go into a parish and one family had a son in Canada and another family had a son as a prisoner of war. And you couldn't coolly talk about, without strong feelings is what I mean. But maybe in some ways those parish discussions and those people living together with sons who had come to different conclusions, both of which were Christian families and Christian young people, maybe that finally is a good experience, but it was a tense time in lots of congregations. Yeah.
The church didn't seem to make that known very much about their position on the Vietnam War.
Yeah. There was one, as far as I know, there was one printed curriculum study guide called U.S. Lutherans, Peace, War, and Conscience. When was it, Mary? It was the first year of the ministry, 72, and I don't want to appear arrogant at all because I didn't write it, but I helped find the six writers and I helped the editing of it, and the response and the number ordered was so minuscule, so few congregations looked at that I'm sure I couldn't have talked them into publishing anything else. Why, I really don't know, because congregations were talking about it. And I thought we were responding with some understanding of the just war criteria, some understanding of amnesty and what that meant. But they're still sitting in the three publishing houses of the Lutheran churches in vast quantities, as far as I know. So, yeah.
What was the name of that? U.S. Lutherans.
U.S. Lutherans. Peace, War, and Conscience. I think for most Lutherans, we simply did not know that there was a kind of, quote, Lutheran position. And if you ask Lutherans what are the criteria for a just war in our own Lutheran tradition, I'm not sure that people come out with those criteria very readily. Yeah.
There isn't a specific Lutheran position, is there, on just war? It would be more or less episode in the Roman Catholic and medieval position.
Yeah, St. Augustine is the one who probably articulated the most. Well, if there is a list, but there is sometimes there are three or four or as many as eight, but no, it's not a Lutheran position, but it's the Protestant, Roman, general Protestant, except for the peace churches, Roman Catholic and Lutheran are all very similar on, as the last resort, and it's mercy to the vanquished, but even the first one in all the lists, after everything else has been tried, well, when does that point come? I mean, how do you ever use the just war criteria? Have you ever tried all the other possibilities? I mean, it's not really a very helpful thing as far as...
I know something of what you're saying because I was a delegate to our LPW convention, just at our Minnesota Synod, a few years ago, and they had something that came up on amnesty. And I never heard such bitterness in my life. There were mothers who had lost sons in the service, and they were really adamant. And I guess it came down to a watered-down position, but they really made a resolution that everybody could follow their conscience, you know, and came back to where it was. They really couldn't knock anything down.
That started to be a lively issue, I believe, at the Washington, D.C. National Convention, the ALC. We had some pretty heated back and forth talk.
In your travels, you've, at the coffee hour after a meeting, or at some place or another after you've spoken about this question, parents have come to you who have probably said, you know, my son or sons are in a national cemetery someplace. What do you say to them?
Well, it seems to me that you do begin the conversation when they begin to understand that the people who were conscientious objectors or the people who are working toward peace have the deepest concern about them and their sons and the fact that sons do die in a war. I mean, it is not there either is a breakthrough or there isn't, on because the first thing that people, when they come that way disturbed, they're reading that what you're saying is our sons made a mistake, or you don't care that they died, when the exact opposite is the case. For the agony is the fact that they did die, and it's not somehow reading them off or saying they were wrong. It's saying somehow there has to be an alternative to the kind of unrestrained violence. That's really what war is. It's unrestrained, overt violence. All the rules are off. And it, you know, there's hardly anybody, I think, who really wants that. So if you can get on that plane where you really are not in some way being critical of the dead son, and then being able to talk the issues involved, I think I've had some good conversations.
You wouldn't answer, well, it was their choice.
No, I think that's a violence, yeah. I mean, that's in essence maybe what when the argument degenerates into that kind of response.
Everybody had a choice.
Yeah, right. Nehemia?
When Gandhi was alive in 1948, before he was shot, the Indian government took military action to unify the Indian state. And Gandhi knew that. He was not in the government, he was in the Congress Party then. And in 1956, his loyal follower, Jawaharlal Nehru, the then Prime Minister, he ordered a naval fight with Portuguese Navy at Goa, the Delta Coast. And later, 1978, yes, the Bangladesh-Pakistan War, Mrs. Gandhi, she's also a loyal, she claims as a Gandhian. And I in India cannot follow Gandhi because not only because of these experiences of war, but also because of the growing inequality, economic, social. Non-violence as a everlasting policy of resistance cannot bring change. What do you think of that?
Gandhi felt that he had failed before he died. You knew that. I mean, we're not the only ones who have said they've left that. I have admitted my mistake. I thought our struggle was based on nonviolence, whereas in reality it was no more than passive resistance. This is his summary of the work that he did, which essentially is a weapon of the weak, and it leads naturally to armed resistance whenever possible. Now, does that mean it would never work? You see, I feel Gandhi had more trust in somehow bringing that which I know to be my personal ethics as I understand it in the New Testament and let that permeate society than we do in the United States, and therefore that's why I want to struggle with it. He really had some trust that which we're called to be individually could permeate the way a government works. By and large, we in the United States say, it's okay for me to be neighbor to one another, and it's okay for me not to protect my house, but the national defense must be the nuclear arsenal because you can't trust the Russians, and nationally we need police and lock up criminals. And I mean, we do not say that personal ethics can be a way in which you run a country or run a Department of Defense or run an economic system. So that the question you ask me seems to me is still the question that will be discussed, if not debated. And I guess if you ask me, is history on the side of large-scale management of people being done on the basis of a Del Vasto or the, I quote, idealism of a Gandhi, there's not a good track record on that. And you can say that again proves human sin or anything else. I don't know if, I guess the point where I would like to have further discussions with you is it seems to me that you still have some sense that nonviolence, as Gandhi lived it, does not address the inequalities and the oppression and the injustices of people. And there, I'm not sure whether you and I, maybe we have a difference of opinion or not. He was vitally interested in those things. Now, the question of whether or not you can get at them nonviolently, that's a legitimate discussion. But almost everything I've tried to say is it is not an ignoring of the inequalities or people being oppressed or... Have we communicated that?
Yeah,
okay.
I understand what you mean.
All right.
The non-violence without violating human persons, personal rights, individual liberty.
Yeah.
How could you bring social justice, economic justice, economic equality?
I guess I don't see why it has to be violent to bring, like, economic equality, unless you mean by violence that if somebody has $1 million and someone else has $10 and someone is throwing food away and the other not eating, that if you have a kind of socialism that says at least we'll all eat, that you've been violent to the person who had to give up part of the food he was throwing away. Well, at that point, I do not call that a violence to the person. Okay. It's a little bit like I walk by and a guy is standing on somebody, has his foot on somebody else's head, and I ask him to move, and his response, well, I don't want to. I've grown to be very happy in this particular position. And it probably is true that but I think for his sake also, he'll be freer if he gets his foot off the person's head. And I think the scriptures call me to have a great concern for the one who's being squashed, and a concern for the one who's squashing, but a concern that includes his being freed from being an oppressor now. So I don't call that violence.
Yeah.
Nonviolence does mean social dislocation, and it does mean economic shifts, but I don't think it's fair to call those violence necessarily.
The situation demands more than that. Like, Bonhoeffer felt that it would be good for Hitler's life, for the whole society, killing of Hitler is good.
Mm-hmm.
In that case, do you have a choice?
Well, you still have a choice, yes. I mean, you may say there's a clearly better choice, or a clearly rational, or even a clearly Christian choice, but it is a choice. Jacques Ellul would say, violence begets violence, nothing else. It never begets anything but more violence. Well, I'm going to listen to that. Even the taking of Hitler's life, Jacques Ellul would say, that taking of life will beget more violence. The idea that sometimes the surgery is necessary, the radical surgery is necessary to save the body, he would discount that kind of argument in the taking of a life. Let's move to just a couple quotes from Martin Luther King, who really refers to Gandhi quite a bit. I want to give you, this is King speaking a little bit to what we've just been talking about. During recent months, I've come to see more and more the need for the method of nonviolence in international relations, not only personal relations. King asked your question. While I was convinced during my student days of the power of nonviolence in group conflicts within a nation, I was not yet convinced of its efficacy in conflict between nations. I felt that while war could never be a positive or absolute good, it could serve as a negative good. I think that's what the killing of Hitler is, a negative good, at least in people's minds. In the sense of preventing the spread and the growth of even a more evil force. War, I felt, horrible as it is, might be preferable to surrender, especially surrender to a totalitarian system. I think that that's the way most of us feel. more and more I've come to the conclusion that the potential destructiveness of modern weapons of war rules out the possibility of war ever serving again as a negative good. If we assume that mankind has a right to survive, then we must find an alternative to war and destruction. The choice is no longer between violence and nonviolence. Now it is a choice between nonviolence or non-existence. Well, you know, maybe people disagree with the kind of input that brought him to that. I am no doctrinaire pacifist. It's interesting that Martin Luther King did not claim that for himself, that he was a doctrinaire pacifist, or in the way most people use that term. I have tried to embrace a kind of realistic pacifism. Moreover, I see the pacifist position not as sinless, but rather as the lesser evil in the circumstances. Therefore, I do not claim to be free from a moral dilemma. The non-pacifist Christian confronts a moral dilemma, so do I. But I'm convinced that the church cannot remain silent while mankind faces the threat of being plunged into the abyss of nuclear annihilation. Let me give you two other King quotes. This is King to, I guess, white society, or Southern white society anyway, when he was in jail. We will match your capacity to inflict suffering with our capacity to endure suffering. We will meet your physical force with soul force. I hope you understand now, since Gandhi's writings, a little bit about what he meant by that. We will not hate you, but we cannot in all good conscience obey your unjust laws. We will soon wear you down by our capacity to suffer, and in winning our freedom, we will so appeal to your heart and conscience that we will also win you in the process. One more quote. The ultimate weakness of violence is that it is a descending spiral begetting the very thing it seeks to destroy. Instead of diminishing evil, it multiplies it. Through violence, you may murder the liar, but you cannot murder the lie, nor establish the truth. Through violence, you murder the hater, but you do not murder hate. In fact, violence merely increases hate. Returning violence for violence multiplies violence, adding deeper darkness to a night already devoid of stars. Darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that. Let me make one more comment as to why I read those last, and then we're out of time anyway. My understanding of the call to the Christian faith is that those things which we might say, well, that's a human reaction, or that's a thing that's necessary, or the world is like that, that conversion or repentance or metanoia, or any of the languages that we use when we say what it is to be baptized or to be a new creature, that literally means being turned around, and things that you used to see one way, you saw a different way. And I kind of challenge you to read the Sermon on the Mount and the teachings of Jesus and not get some clear, shaking kind of thing in your life that which is kind of conforming to this world, that we are called to be transformed from within and have a different way of seeing things. Even our rights, how you respond when people do you in, how you respond in conflict situations, that one of the things that it means to accept the Lordship of Christ, if I read the New Testament correctly, is at least being referred to. Whether you come to the answers that these people come to, it seems to me we're all responsible for the same kinds of questions that they ask, namely, what's a faithful response? And I think that we are usually thinking of our rights, and if I read the New Testament correctly, the only right we really have is the right to be a servant, and that's still a scandal. And I don't know how you... I don't know how you fill churches with that kind of gospel, and yet as I read the scriptures, that's really the gospel we've been given. And I hope that we still wrestle with it, because I still think that's a gospel. I still think that's a good news, and it never was advertised as not being costly. I don't know how we can come through Lent and then get upset when the gospel is as costly as it is. So somehow it seems to me these people, whether they're technically and orthodoxy, Christian or Lutheran, either one, seems to me they're wrestling with the kind of question that we're called to deal with. So, good wrestling with it.
How about Alexander Solzhenitsyn?
I haven't read much.
I haven't read much either, but you know, he got an awful lot of static after his graduation speech, you know, and it was really kind of just a warning, you know, to the Americans, but I think everybody took such a stand at that time, you know, and couldn't quite figure out.
The national reaction was fascinating. I mean, he said it. He said we're morally weak and flabby folk, and everybody just booted and howled from one end of the country to the other, including from the White House. You know, in response to that, I just thought the reaction was fascinating. Okay, made me smile.
Thank you for coming. Have a good evening. We have a picnic coming up soon. If you're still here Sunday and want to talk about Thomas Merton a little bit, we'll do that in here Sunday morning.